jazz.
Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 125. I'm Pat. Some people call me Wine Light. Some people call me Cool Breeze. And I'm here with Mr. Mellow. But Mike, isn't it true the ladies really call you Soul Box?
I hope not. I get more and more rectangular every year, but let's hope I'm not a box yet.
Hey, you're my soul box. So we're kind of doing a follow-up to Jazz Bastard episode 63, where Mike led us down into the inferno of smooth jazz. And listeners, if you haven't dialed that one up, it is a memorable episode. I've been listening to some of it again. I said, wow, there's some amazing events on this episode. And that one, we covered Kenny G, Bob James, Spira Gyra. We really kind of went into the heart of darkness.
You're leaving out Chris Botti.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I was trying to think of who the fourth mellow avatar was.
You deliberately forgot the cute blonde European.
That must be it. And believe me, as someone who's surrounded right now by cute blonde Europeans, hard to do. Many of them trying to kill me with their bicycles. It's just great. So that was kind of the developed flower that was smooth jazz. And remains, you know, that market niche. There was a whole radio format. It was a huge powerhouse for a certain period of time.
It still is. If you're driving and you get on the FM, the upper echelons of FM in any urban area, you'll hear,
yeah,
this is Malcolm with the Quiet Storm. Right. You know, you'll hear that show. You know?
Yeah. I mean, what I've read anyway is, my impression is that it was almost a mainstream powerhouse kind of thing for a while. And yeah. I don't know that I can place that in time, whether it was the 90s, the 80s, and that as a format, it has lost some of its centrality and some of its market share. I think that in the last 15 to 20 years, for whatever reason, the tiny markets that were jazz and classical have shrunk further. And there's been kind of what people thought was going to expand everybody's mind, the endless buffet of the internet and free music for all, has, I think, by its sheer plenitude, almost shrunk it, because now you're not going to run into something you don't know serendipitously listening on the radio or whatever. You're going to kind of, you know, if confronted with everything that Spotify owns, one, they're pimping the most recent populist hits, and two, maybe you only know one or two search terms. So somehow that the market shrunk even further. And my sense is that it is not the force it used to be. Not that it's disappeared, but it was not at its crest the way it was 20, 25 years ago. Anyway, just because of a couple of recordings I'd accumulated recently, I thought, well, let's do another show that's roughly based on this idea. But I feel like what's happened instead is I really assembled some recordings that are more the prehistory of smooth jazz, and three of them are kind of, well, Sanborn, you might say, is in it, but even he, there's some question. Three of them are kind of a particular lineage, and then one album that a lot of people think of as the flag that was planted, that kind of established a genre, and that's George Benson's Breezin'. So the albums we're going to be talking about are, of course, Breezin' by George Benson, and that's from 1976 on Warner Brothers. Grover Washington Jr.'s Soul Box, from 1973 on Kudu, and this was like a subsidiary of CTI. Hank Crawford's Don't You Worry About a Thing on Kudu from 1975, and David Sanborn's Voyeur from 1981 on Warner Brothers. And boy, at least to me, you sure as fuck know you're in the 80s when you listen to Voyeur.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's real clear. And then all sorts of things in the hopper for pop time. So any preferences where you want to go here? Should we just do it chronologically?
Sure, that's fine.
What do you want to do here? Well, I'll tell you what, let's depart from that a little bit, and that I think we should do the three alto players together, and then maybe we'll look at Breezin', which is kind of its own thing.
Sure.
So Some of these just have to do with things I picked up at the record store. Mike supplied Voyeur, but the Grover Washington and Hank Crawford are things I've just kind of got. And I guess I've reached a stage in my life where this particular kind of music has got more appeal to me. I don't know, what would you call the Grover Washington album? Is it soul jazz? I mean, I don't listen to Soul Box and think this is easy listening or mellow jazz. This is smooth jazz yet, but what are your thoughts?
I don't either. I think he's more in a soul bag. It's the strings that throw you, but he's more in a soul bag, I would say. I think he's more of a soul performer.
Yeah, when we say that, it's a little hard to define. I was thinking, for me, the bridge figure, and even though we're doing Grover first chronologically in terms of his release, he's born 1943, but the elder here in this group is Hank Crawford, who's born 34. And you kind of feel like he's a bit of a fountainhead for these players. Certainly David Sanborn gives him props. But I was trying to think, when I listen to Grover play a standard, and he plays a couple jazz standards on this album, this is a kind of an anomaly. And I'd say that if you're a jazz fan who's interested in Grover, I don't know all of Grover's work, but I would certainly recommend starting here, because I think there's a lot of good jazz content in it. And there are also some songs that are bridges. And I was trying to think, well, is there anybody that I've had before that's a little bit in this bag? And the guy I thought of was Lou Donaldson, the alto player who made a lot of albums on Blue Note. And I've got a couple of his soul releases that are organ and just a little plodding. Donaldson begins as a bebopper. If you hear him, like with the Jazz Messengers, he's playing kind of a somewhat stripped down Charlie Parker kind of music. And then he moves into funk, soul jazz, whatever you want to call it. And there's this amazing album he does of standards with medium-sized band backing, or I think arranged by Wayne Shorter, and Shorter plays tenor on that album, called Lush Life. And he's basically just kind of playing standards over this bed. And he'll solo some, but a lot of it's about him just declaring these melodies. And to me, it's like, well, he's a little bit in that mold. He's like, you know, the father of people like Hank Crawford or Grover. But I think one of the differences is the kind of short declarative ejaculations that the soul players play, you know, the kind of blah, you know, the Grover will do occasionally, and certainly Hank will do. It just seems like more tied to the church, more directly tied. Whereas Lou, I'm sure, has got some roots in the church, but he smoothed it out. He's made it more part of the jazz tradition. So he doesn't yelp. He doesn't do those high leaps. And to me, that's, I don't know, maybe a little Sam Cooke. You were talking about Sam Cooke the other week. There's a little bit of that in there, a little soul declaring. But anyway, Soul Box was a double album, and my copy is not as clean as I'd like it to be. 7 songs, so some of them go on a long way. Yep. And it's Grover in front of an orchestra. Do you know who provided all that orchestration?
No, but you're going to tell me.
I am. And it ties back to our episode 63. It was Bob James.
Huh.
And he does the writing on the Crawford album. So I just have never studied Bob James and probably want to keep it that way. But we talked about way back in 63, you know, his album with Errol Clue that was just incredibly pallid, I don't know, what do you want to call it? Pap jazz, whatever, a jazz formula for the jazz baby. And that way back in the 60s, he was like an avant-garde piano player for a hot minute. Apparently, his transition between those two states was doing arrangements, which I think are pretty good, and playing some piano and keyboards on CTI and Kudo projects. So I just, again, and not study the guy, but I don't. I kind of like the arrangements on this album. I don't mind the lushness. How do you feel about them?
I'm a little less enamored of the lushness. For me, the most interesting thing here is Washington's shrill alto, and it does seem a little shrill. It's not Jackie McLean sharp, but I wonder what it would sound like if you pulled all the orchestration away. I wonder if you'd say, "That's hurting my something's being scratched." I don't know. I actually think the arrangements, the orchestration, the synths, the keyboards kind of rope this back into middle middle ground listening. Whereas if this was just Grover Washington playing with a rhythm section, I think there are times he would hurt your ears. He just has a kind of biting. He's, like I said, he's not quite Jackie McLean sharp, but man, he gets there. There are times when I'm like, So yeah, you know, his playing here is the most interesting thing. And I guess I'm grateful for the orchestrations because they kind of sand off some of the edges and make this a little more palatable. But man, this is real close to elevator, dentist office, waiting room music oftentimes, especially a couple of the numbers. Sunshine of My Life. Oh, that's a tough one. And the opener, I don't know if it's the opener, Aubrey, holy cats. When you hear them, it's really hard not to think you're in a waiting room. They gave me trouble. The longer numbers here get on my nerves as well. I mean, really? 16 minutes for Trouble Man? Really? And it's not 16.
He's a lot of trouble.
It's not 16 minutes of Grover. It's about, I don't know, would you say 7-8 minutes of Grover? And 5 or 6 minutes of other people noodling around who I don't really give a shit about and can't be brought to care about very much over that lush orchestration. So, yeah, I'm a little less patient with this stuff than maybe some of the stuff we listened to on 63. This gets on my nerves a little bit. And I remember liking Wine Light better than this. I didn't go back and listen to it. I couldn't bring myself to do that. But yeah, it's Washington's playing that's kind of interesting to me. He's a little shrill, but then there's a lot of extra stuff on here that just, and I don't know about you, but I feel like I can feel the beginnings of disco in some of this. Can you, the sort of groove on some of the peppier stuff? It feels like you can hear what's going to be, I don't know. What I do appreciate here, I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. The other thing I like a little bit on here are the brass arrangements. So in addition to the strings and some sort of noodly synths in the background, which get on my nerves, there's some nice punched up brass arrangements here with trumpets, trombones, what have you. Those I like. And they appear in the longer numbers where, is it Bob James who does all the arranging here?
I believe so. Okay. I think he does, I believe, the whole record. Right.
So on these longer numbers, they're almost suites. I mean, they're not, you know, they have movements almost. I'm talking about Masterpiece, Trouble Man, and Don't Explain, all of which come in at over 10 minutes. And the medley, Easy Living Ain't Nobody's Business But My Own, is pretty close too. And these kind of have almost like movements. They change tempos. And anyway, I like the brass sections when they pop in here. So I guess what I'm saying is I like the more obviously jazz content on this album, and anything toward the smoothness, the synth washes, the strings, that gets on my nerves. And I'm a lot less patient with this one than, say, Wine Light, which I think I liked a little better than this. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of this. I don't think I'll have to listen to this again anytime soon. His playing's all right. When he's in the lower register, he doesn't sound sharp. He sounds almost meditative and thoughtful. But when the tempo gets pushed and he goes into the higher register on the horn, man, he's pushing my pain threshold a little bit. Not a big fan. Didn't like this a whole lot. Don't hate it. I don't know. Like, half parts of it I like, but all the songs seem overripe and overdone to me. Just too much.
Yeah, they're definitely productions. Yeah, these are not just performances. They're productions, right? As you said, they're kind of, the arrangements take center stage a lot of the time. There are the multi-parts to some of them, contrasting textures. James or someone has written some counter melodies or riffs that kind of flesh out the actual songs being played. Thank you. some of those get repeated as motifs, you know, sometimes for, as you said, over 10 minutes. They come and go. In Washington, I'd say as a player, yeah, this is very much about bite and vinegar and sweet, right? That the orchestration of the background is not always mellow, but fairly smooth, I guess. And then, you know, Washington's testifying over it is, as you said, kind of piercing. And I think that what happens, if the tempo really picks up, is that Hill will start playing licks, and I think they're better organized than some of Kenny G's jazzgasms that he has. But there's a certain repetition. And that's the thing with, you know, when you're preaching, repetition is an important part of what you're doing. But there's that borderline between repeating something for emphasis and building a mood, and just after a while sounding like a stuck record, like you're just not sure what you want to say next. And there are moments where I feel like Grover crosses that line. He just seems to be, you know, playing a lick into the ground because he's trying to get some kind of epiphany going or moment of excitement in the listener. Or maybe he's just treading water. Maybe he's just ran out of licks for the moment. You know, it's hard to say. But sometimes it can be very dramatic when you're, and this will happen, like Grant Green is a real problem with this. Sometimes he'll just play a lick and it's like, okay, Grant, that's great. But dude, stop.
Give us something
and,
else.
You know, just do it over and over again. And I think, you know, and he's kind of from a hard jazz background going into soul jazz movement towards the end of his life, you know, the same deal where he's not the world's most fertile mind for coming up with new jazz lines. He's not the most technically flabbergasting player,
yeah.
But he's got a directness that appeals to a lot of listeners and a sound that's very identifiable, both of them, Grant Green and Grover. And so they reach people in a way that musicians with maybe greater talents, we'd argue, don't. Yeah, I liked it, I think, better. I mean, certainly, You Are the Sunshine of My Life, that's kind of Kenny G, right? Yeah. It's, you know, the soprano saxophone playing a melody pretty.
Do you like his soprano playing? I like his soprano playing better than his alto playing.
I guess for me, the vinegar in the alto, the sharpness, whatever you want to call it, the bite, works in this context. I think it, in fact, in some ways, it makes it work better because as a soul man, as opposed to a smooth man, you know, that is, I guess I'm trying to get to this idea that this particular tradition has that element, and that element completely, one thing that I think Bob James and his own music figured out is that's what listeners don't want. They don't want the vinegar. Just give them nothing but the poplum. And then if you're looking for just mellow, just smooth, that mix is a little too challenging. It's a little too, churchy, maybe. We might bring in images like it's a little too black. And so get rid of it. And one thing about this production is that it incorporates it. So I think the sopranos probably, and I think he became known more for soprano, played tenor, alto, and
right.
Soprano. So anyway, I think I like this better than you do. I like the arrangements pretty well. I don't mind the long songs because to me, in a sense, the point of a lot of these numbers is establishing a groove. It's about an extended experience. The bottom is probably more important than the top to some degree, I guess. In other words, just is it being sustained? Is it moving? And I think the level of musicianship, the players they've got, they're quite good.
Yeah. I was going to say, if we could cut the strings out, there's a great quintet here, or a quintet that I'd like to hear, or maybe a quartet I'd like to hear, because it's got Dick Davis on bass and Ron Carter on bass and Idris Muhammad on drums. That's a great start. Unfortunately, Bob James is playing all that electric shit on the piano, and I don't think he's that interesting. And then the horn section's fantastic. There's a bunch of really good players. It's the strings that really kill me, that really get on my nerves. I feel like there's a decent quintet in here wanting to get out, or maybe a quartet in search of a piano player. I don't know.
And that may be, I think for people of our age, there is the disco bump, and some never get over it.
Yeah.
And it's and some, of course, loved it from the beginning. It's how do you feel about that movement? And as a kid, reflexively didn't like it. Joyce was a big fan, and, you know, she kind of got me over the bump.
I like it sometimes. I like some of it. So I don't have a knee-jerk reaction to it. But it's the strings. It's the strings and synths combo that really gets on my nerves, I think.
And I guess it's sweetening, but it doesn't. I don't know that it's not a red flag for me. Now, I got to say, I don't focus on it. I don't think the string writing is nearly as interesting as the brass writing.
Agreed.
There are apparently live recordings of Grover from around this period. But that said, to me, I don't know that I do want to hear Grover in the context of a combo, because I think he's a solid player. I don't think he's a fascinating player. I feel like if this is probably about as jazzy as he gets. It's kind of an unusual production. If you've only heard his later stuff, it's a lot more rough and ready. There's a lot more open jazz content in it. For God's sakes, he's nodding to Billie Holiday and plays Easy Living. I think he's fine here. I think he does a good job of testifying. But I don't know, as an improviser, he's somebody I need to listen to at length. I just think there's just so many great alto and tenor and soprano saxophone players in the jazz tradition that I don't know that I put him in the top two-thirds of that category. I just don't think he's as gifted at creating melody other than riffing powerfully, emoting directly, and I keep going back to this term, testifying. And in this context, with a lot of things going on behind him and this excellent band and moments where it's not him center stage, I kind of like it better, I think, than I would undiluted Grover Washington Jr. just playing. So anyway, I'd say that to me, I think this would be an interesting bridge. You're absolutely right that if you just hate syrupy strings or you don't like the idea of a jazz production, period, this won't appeal to you. And this is not Grover in front of a small combo. This is Grover in a context very much. But if you don't mind that, I've kind of grown to like some aspects of that. You know, I would not want to make this the only part of my diet, but, right. You know, I've got a soft
apparently
spot.
Apparently there's he does have some mainstream. So he wasn't a guy who just dined out on his reputation as a setting for as the jewel in Bob James arrangements. There's a vinyl LP out there of him with Kenny Burrell,
right,
with Ron Carter and Jack DeJohnette. I mean, so there's some straight ahead jazz, or at least ensembles that look like straight ahead jazz groups with players of pretty good rep, pretty high caliber. I'd be interested to give those a listen, as opposed to, you know, I don't know that I need to hear Soulbox again anytime soon, or Mr. Magic, or Feels So Good, but I wouldn't mind hearing that Kenny Burrell album. I think the Kenny Burrell album might be interesting.
Yeah, well, he had an association briefly with Blue Note. I remember they had a big anniversary concert. It might have been the 70s. I don't know which one it was. And he appears on that. There's like a 4-LP box of all the various. And, you know, Burrell was on it. Jackie McLean appeared. Cecil Taylor was given a couple, I believe. You know, they really brought back a lot of people from the history. And he was on it. And I think he did make a couple more or less straight jazz records. And then he died relatively young.
Yeah, he died in 99. So he's in his 50s.
So, you know, he did. But a lot of these figures, you know, they're always, there's a popular perception of what an artist is about. And then there's their actual history and their own interests. And you get the sense that Grover was always kind of on that borderline. He had some chops. He had some interest in jazz, but he also had this ability to kind of communicate with people and got involved in the more produced side of things. But, you know, he would then kind of come back. So, again, a figure that if you've only heard some of his mellowest hits, or younger listeners may just not have heard of him. Maybe I have a little bit more affection in my heart just for 70s artifacts, and this is very much Soulbox.
Oh, yes.
It's called Soulbox, motherfucker. It is very much a 70s artifact.
This label, there's a bunch of, there's several Bob James arranged, I think even his first album, I'm checking now, All the King's Horses before this is another kudu Bob James extravagant. Yeah, and so is his first album. His first album, Inner City Blues, same thing. Bob James and a cast of thousands. So it seems like they got a formula.
Yeah, yeah.
And, by the time we get to Soulbox, they've been doing this for a while. These leader dates under Washington's name, they do a bunch of these in a row. And it's Bob James arrangements, strings. It looks like in-house horn players. You know, these are all guys they keep coming back to. So they kind of hit a formula, I guess, when he was a leader, and they milk it through the 70s, it looks like.
So anyway, another one I think kind of very much in this wheelhouse, and I talked about it briefly on a Pop Matter segment a while back, Hank Crawford's Don't You Worry About a Thing. And as my story went, I picked this up because I got obsessed with that Stevie Wonder song since it was the finale of Sing, the movie about singing animals. And what I took away from that movie is that this is a really fucking great song.
Stop.
That was a movie with nothing on its mind.
We don't need to hear about the mouse again. Stop.
named Mike.
I'm going to point out that Crawford was supposed to be on one or the other of Washington's first two kudu dates. And Crawford is a kudu man as well, although he has a pre-career, as it were. Like he's a player in the 60s. He's got a decade of active life before he gets to Creed Taylor's soft focus jazz unit. But apparently he was supposed to be on a couple of those. I was reading that he was left off of or couldn't make the date for Inner City Blues or the second one that Grover did. But, you know, Don't You Worry About a Thing is, you know, it's more of the same. It's almost the same personnel.
And, of course, Crawford also played in Ray Charles's band.
And he's got roots, and he's a serious soul player. Like, he really does fit the soul category more. I don't know if you have any of the Jimmy McGriff stuff, but he plays with Jimmy McGriff, and he also plays with... Oh, no, I've got two of those Jimmy McGriff albums. And that's just... great heapings of soul. It's remember that place, that restaurant on State Street in Chicago, Soul on State, where you can go and get chitlins and pinto beans and cornbread? Hank Crawford and Jimmy McGriff is like Soul on State.
There you go. I was going to say, they wouldn't let me in there for some reason. So be gone, Blondie boy. Out you go.
So he's more of a soul player than I'd say Washington is.
Yeah, more in that tradition. And I kind of assume, because of course, when we move on to Sanborn very much bases his thing on Hank.
Right.
That some of the whole testifying and the yelping sound, you get these kind of abrupt phrases that are strongly cut off. I realize sometimes if I play classical music on the saxophone that, oh yeah, I've been kind of playing jazz and I haven't tongued for the last hour. You know, I'm not used to it. How does this work again?
Right.
How do you stop it? Because you don't necessarily do a lot of that in the jazz idiom. I mean, it depends on what you're playing, but it's just a very different approach to articulation. And I feel like soul sax will have these more abrupt cutoff phrases that kind of startle you. That's their goal, in a sense. And I kind of assume that Ray Charles was a bit of a model in his vocalizing and his approach. Kind of, you know, the saxophones in that group. And, of course, the other well-known player was David Newman.
Yeah.
I've praised some of his stuff pretty extensively. I mean, I like David a lot. I think as a player of this circle, of these people we associate in the style, he's probably my favorite. I certainly, so far, have liked him better than Crawford. But again, I wonder how much of that was kind of absorbed at the master's feet, as it were. I don't know. I don't know where this... You know, there's a rhythm and blues saxophone tradition that obviously goes back quite a ways. And there are people like Lou Donaldson, who doesn't have that kind of articulation or sharpness, but played in that style from an earlier generation. But as to where it all kind of comes from, I don't know. But, well, we'll talk about Sanborn in a minute. But anyway, yeah, this one thing I noticed about this was the title track. Man, that sucker moves. You know, Don't You Worry About a Thing. He takes it a lot of beats per minute faster than Stevie. I like that a lot. I don't know how you felt about it.
I like this album significantly better than Grover Washington's. I still want to blow up the arrangements. I want to just get rid of the string section. But part of the reason I like this better is Crawford is a dirtier player than Washington. Crawford will slur his notes a little bit. He'll get a little buzz. He doesn't quite get to any multiphonics, thank God. But he's got a dirtier sound. He's a little more rough and ready. What you were talking about with the kind of soul attack, he will bite off some of his phrases. Like, this is not about legato, right? Or to put it a different way, it's really hard to imagine Kenny G playing like this. Crawford definitely has a little more dirt in his ass. And this just has, in spite of the antiseptic strings behind all of this, Crawford is busy. He's much more of a soul funk player. In fact, I don't know. I could have used less strings and like
15 times more bass on this. I can't even hear the bass hardly on this album, which really got on my nerves after a while. I don't know. It just felt like they were substituting the brass section for bottom. And Gary King, who plays bass here, is just, is he in the mix? Is he in the studio? Did they hook up his, did they hook up his amplifier? I mean, I can't hear him at all. I can hear Pepper Adams on Barry more than I can hear him.
Yeah. I mean, as stacked as it is, I don't know that a bass player gets to have the same initiative or power that he or she would have in a combo, just because there's so much going on. In a sense, it's probably a click track somewhere, as Matt.
The album is a panda, and I want it to be like a grizzly bear, you know? And it's like, no, it's a panda. It's a really good panda. It can't be a grizzly bear. Stop wishing for grizzly bears. Just enjoy the pandaness of it all. So you're right.
Yeah. Pandas can get pretty mean. Yeah. Don't take their bamboo. They'll hurt you. Right. They'll cut you. To me, I guess, you know, when we say antiseptic, we get it, but it is finally, it's analog recording of studio musicians. There is some synth sometime, but it's precisely the kind of music that people got super nostalgic about and real excited when, who are the French Robots? God, I can see them, but I can't think of
Daft
that,
Punk?
That huge.
Yeah. No, I don't know.
There you go. You know, no, you're absolutely right. The Daft Punk release that was kind of bringing back those disco sounds, and people just really, because I don't think the song craft on that album is all that interesting, but what they're swooning over is, oh my God, this sounds like something made in the studio in the 1970s. And so we've reached a point of nostalgia for it. And when we talk about Voyeur, we can understand why, because that goes away.
Right.
This production, just like the Grover Washington, it is slick, but it's still analog, organic slick, in that it's human beings making a slick sound,
right.
Very well-trained studio musicians cutting something to analog tape that was soothing, but still involved several human beings at once, etc.
How about that Joe Farrell on flute here?
Yeah, hey, you know, Joe's a working man. Yeah. One album I didn't get to listen to again, when we do George Benson, there is an album called Benson and Farrell.
Oh, wow.
Whereas Joe and George Benson, and the cover is like, the idea is they're a cigarette brand. So there's like a cigarette box instead of Benson and Hedges, I guess. You know, only in the 70s. I don't think they'd be doing that now. But my memory of that album is it's just so bland. Mm. But anyway, I think, yeah, you could argue that Crawford to Grover to Kenny G. And it, mm-hmm. it's kind of evolution in reverse.
Yes.
But you know,
I think that's exactly right.
And I don't want to rip on, I mean, I think that what's interesting about Grover is that he's got a very liquid, full, ripe sound. And sometimes it does get overripe, but he kind of brings a sweetness
right.
to the Hank Crawford model, but he keeps some of the edge.
He hasn't gone full Rococo like Kenny G has.
No, no. And by the time you get to Kenny G, you get the feeling that Kenny has never listened to, met, or been near Ray Charles right. or the Church. Maybe the synagogue, but it wasn't a funky synagogue.
That's right. Is that a bass? Get it away from me. Get it away.
Any other thoughts on Hank?
No. I like this. It's the same house, same arranger, but a little more gritty of a player. And for that reason, I like it a little bit better. And I guess I still want to get rid of the strings, but this is marginally better to me than the Grover Washington.
And nothing quite, you know, over the 10-minute mark. I mean, there's nothing quite as extensive as and ambitious as some of the productions on Soulbox, where they really stretch out. So if you're not looking for multi-part suites and lots of complicated writing, this is a little bit more direct. Okay, well, one guy that paid a lot of homage to Hank Crawford and arguably built his career on Hank's sound, a modified version of it, is David Sanborn, and he's very open about this. He's a pretty humble guy. Had a lot of success kind of, I feel like, defining the New York saxophone sound on alto in the way Mike Brecker did on tenor, and worked with people like Gil Evans, So he certainly had a jazz background, but ended up doing a lot of, I don't know, I don't know if you called voyeur, I guess you could call voyeur smooth jazz. What would you call it?
I don't know. There's something about the way he's recorded that is both so much of that era, and yet I like it. Like, from the opening strains of Let's Just Say Goodbye, you know you are in the 80s. Like, when you hear it, two bars in, you're like, oh, it's 1984. Like, you know exactly where you are in terms of time. But I like his playing in this context. It's how do they get that sound? He's very dry, but they've got a little echo, a little reverb on there. Like, it sounds like a contradiction in terms, right? But he's got this very dry tone. It's not a very wet sound, but they've got reverb on it somehow. I don't know how they do that, but I kind of like it.
The producer on this one is Marcus Miller, and a few sessions back, we did talk about another David Sanborn album, kind of his recent release, Time in the River, and that was, you know, one from decades later with that same pairing. So Sanborn, he's really about the same generation as Grover Washington Jr. He's born in 45, Grover was born in 43, where Hank again was born back in 34. Marcus Miller's 1959, So a little younger guy. And he was kind of an up-and-comer there. He's known to jazz fans for his productions with Miles Davis. He's a player on We Want Miles, some of Miles' live stuff, and he also produced Tutu and a couple others for him. And yeah, there's this very... Synthesizers are there, and of course the slap bass. And Miller also plays a mean bass clarinet. I mean, he's a very talented guy. And yeah, it is a very 80s sound.
Yeah. Very bright, very brightly recorded synthesizers. This isn't the Wash. This is the tinkly, tinkly stuff.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, two songs with background vocals. Those need to go.
Right. They are as pandering as anything.
All I Need Is You, and right. It's You. Apparently, the word you means you have to have vocalists. I don't know. Although they managed to avoid it on the final song, Just For You. So there's that. But yeah, the vocals need to go. That's bad. That's a very bad moment here. They're not actually singing the song. They're just in the chorus like, all I need is you. You know, it's like, no. All I need is you to shut the fuck up.
Oh, right. It's a sweetening. Yes. Right. It's like, but you're bringing in, it's just like another part of the arrangement. Like, you yes. bring in strings, ugh. You bring in women singing, cooing in the background as an element of the arrangement. Mm-hmm. It's not a featured vocal. It's just kind of another smooth seasoning.
Yeah. There.
And yeah, I agree. Those are extremely cheesy. This is a weird record and it's very short. I was listening to it in the Botanical Garden. I'm like, what? Did my player run out of battery? Nope, it's just done, you know, 35 minutes, boom.
That's right. David gives you value for money, or I don't know, he gets in and he gets out. I don't know.
There you go. And
something.
Yeah, the last number is a duet between him and Marcus Miller on piano, and it's really yeah. weird because in a way it's the most organic piece. It's just the two of them playing. But then they fade it out. I'm like, my God, don't do that.
I know. I know. It's terrible.
I think that's why I thought the battery had run out, because I'm like, you don't, if this is two of you, just end it. That's fine. But don't fucking fade it out. What were you thinking there? So that very strange choice. But yeah, it's like an album in a hurry to get done. But it's weird because I think in many ways it's a very synthetic sound. It's kind of an airless sound he's a very tight.
Yes.
Miller, and I like his bass playing, but it's a sense of tightness, a sense of just everything being kind of ratcheted up and focused and machine tooled. But it seems to know that that's what it's selling, and so it works in a way that, on its own terms, it's like, I'm trying to be the most of this I can be, and I'm doing a really good job of it. So you kind of say, okay, well, now we think of it as you're trying to sound as 80s as humanly possible, but it's just, it's Marcus. I mean, in a sense, these productions, he's some one of the people that created that sound. You know, he's an architect of the 80s.
I also think of this as like the, on the more up-tempo numbers, I think of this as the Saturday Night Live band sound. Let's just say goodbye. Sounds like G.E. Smith and the Saturday Night Live band.
Absolutely. And again, that's where I tend to think of, if you want the cliche, and they may still be doing it. I've not watched that show for decades, it seems like. But that sound of the saxophone on that band, it's just like, it's the Brecker Brothers. It's David Sanborn. It's this sound that was codified in the 70s that does have some links back to like a Hank Crawford, but somehow got... Again, I go back to machine-tooled, cliché-ridden, I don't know, just kind of focused down to kind of a lexicon of gestures that probably is more mechanically, technically accomplished sometimes than Hank, but the soul, the southernness of it is gone. The soul is kind of, it's replaced with this kind of urbanization of it. And
white Sanborn, urbanization.
Yeah, but urban, right? I mean, this is... people trying to reach an audience that is not just white, and certainly not the audience that listens to Garth Brooks. I mean, this is, it's urban, whatever that means. And it's looking for ears of both races, but it is still polished up the sound that like a Crawford would make.
It's that sweet OBX synthesizer with its little tinkly, twinkly.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, to me in a way, it kind of depends on where you sit chronologically and where your nostalgia lies and where your loyalties lie and where maybe there's still some festering wounds. But this, in a way, you could argue sounds more dated, at least it may in certain ways more dated to me than the Kudo stuff. It's not. I mean, obviously it's more recent, but they're both production styles very much of their time. And when we really say dated, we don't mean that everything is dated, for fuck's sake. Everything was made in a certain year or era. Everything was following the conventions of its time or challenging them. But was, you know, and contextualized by its time. There's no escaping it. If you're reacting against minimalism, it's because minimalism was big, or whatever you want to say. In the classical world, for an example, it's that, do we right now at this moment think of that particular period as one that speaks to us, or one that seems distant and aesthetically unsuccessful? Are we getting nostalgic and a warm feeling and appreciation for 70s studio production because we're so tired of EDM? And we just long, if we're going to have dance music, for fuck's sake, we have real electric guitars and a real drummer and real strings and not this shit. Then all of a sudden, what was maybe annoying to people 30 years ago or whatever, or maybe seemed dated to them 10 years ago, is now not dated anymore. It's timeless. To some degree, you know, if you're listening to like, what the fuck's his name? Bruno Mars. I was reading something about the third or fourth lawsuit against Uptown Funk. Because
Bruno Mars.
Thank you. Bruno Mars would be a really interesting. I want to hear Bruno Mars.
Like, wait, is this someone I haven't heard of? I'm like, no, it's not. Never mind. Sorry.
It's the fifth Mars brother. Yeah, he was really obscure. Thank you. I was going to ask you what you thought of David Sanborn's playing on this.
Oh, I like it. I like his playing. Although, like I said before, I think of it as that Saturday Night Live style, so that his licks and songs sound so familiar, even though I haven't listened to this album dozens of times. It's the kind of thing you can imagine someone playing in the closing moments of the Saturday Night Live cast, waving goodbye to the studio audience. The licks are familiar, and I don't know that it's not his fault. Probably when he played these licks when this album came out, they were fresh, but it's become such a style that now it's like, I've heard this, the sort of slightly squally, soulful... That's a helpless adjective. That's not really helping. As songs build, these songs don't really build, but as the chorus carries on, he will kind of go higher on the register of the horn. He will get, he doesn't quite squonk or squawk, but he gets closer to doing that. The playing gets a little more urgent and frenetic before the fade outs. And that's a style that I associate with that sort of closing credits on, you know, the David Letterman show or Saturday Night Live of a certain era. If it's a cliche now, it wasn't probably when he was playing it, but it's become a cliche. That's slightly irksome, but
Yeah, I like whatever they've done to his tone here, to the way they've recorded it, this sort of, like I said, he's got a really dry tone to my ear, but with that reverb on it, and it's just right up in your ears. The mix, he's very high in the mix, and I kind of appreciate that. You can really hear what he's doing. And I do like his playing. I mean, he's never going to be one of my top 20 saxophone players, but I always find him pleasant, and sometimes he makes me sit up and notice what he's doing. So he's pretty good value for money, if you ask me. But he's not a titan on the horn by any stretch, and I'm sure he wouldn't say he was either. I don't think that's the kind of player he aims to be. Yeah, I kind of like his playing here. I don't know. How about you?
Yeah, well, there is, and I was going to set myself this task. Any good musician would be able to tell you, but there's like the soul note, and it's some interval above the tonic that you go, wah! Right. It's got a certain relationship to the chord, and you're going to hear it again and again and again, especially in Sanborn's right. playing. In some ways, I think he's taken the range of devices available to like a Grover Washington Jr. or a Hank Crawford and kind of boiled them down to an essence. And they become a much more identifiable signifier of kind of soulfulness. And I think you touched on something I didn't quite get, but you're absolutely right that the production and presentation of his sound, it does move it into a new era, and it's very distinctive. And it kind of, I think, again, solidifies what does it mean to have an urban soul saxophone, let's say in the 80s forward. It kind of, that maybe is what really sets him apart, along with probably his location, his connections, maybe the fact he was white, I don't know, as opposed to like a Hank Crawford or a, just, you know, Grover obviously had a great deal of success. I feel like Hank was not quite as popular, and maybe because he had the more grit. You know, I think he did fine, but I don't know that he ever quite hit it big the way that Grover did and Sanborn did. And maybe some of it's the production. I think sometimes I'll hear Sanborn kind of grind in place. He'll play the same lick maybe too often, and he'll certainly play that soul note maybe more often than he needs to. It starts to lose its effectiveness just because it's repeated so much. But yeah, it's a fascinating document. It's an album that I must have flipped past in the bins dozens of times as a kid. Sanborn was another one of these artists that would always be there in the mall, right? He'd always have a few David Sanborn albums. And, you know, I saw him on, it was like Night Music. He had some kind of show. I think I saw that in England. It must have been about 14, 15 years ago, about when Rand was 3 and we were living there that year. I remember seeing the Red Hot Chili Peppers before they were famous and thinking, ugh. But anyway, he was a good host there. And I did just last night listen to the last album Bobby Hutcherson made was Enjoy the View with Joey DeFranc Francesco, the organ player, and David Sanborn and Billy Hart. And really, I think in some ways, from what little I've heard of it, maybe people were underselling that. It is certainly not wildly innovative or anything, but the band sounds relaxed. And if you want to hear David in a jazz mold, that's him playing outside of the, as it were, the soul box. And, you know, you listen to him and you think, okay, he's fine. And he's certainly responding to his surroundings. He sounds like he's playing for real. He's not a genius. So if you've not listened to, say, Miles Davis's To-Do, or We Want Miles to a Lesser Extent, or listen to this, you know, Marcus Miller, boy, he's got a fingerprint. He is an identifiable producing mind. You hear it and it's indelible. And yeah, he's got his mark all over this. And as producers go, it could be worse. He's certainly a very talented musician. I mean, again, he's maybe a little airless sometimes, maybe just a little bit too tightly wound and too perfectionist for my taste, but interesting record. And really, you know, compared to 63, I've enjoyed all this pretty well.
Right.
You know, it's not been like going to walking on the broken glass the way that was. So that was kind of a pleasant surprise. Well, anyway, if you're ready, we'll move on to the atom bomb and the smooth jazz story, the foundational document for some people. not because this was the first smooth jazz recording ever made, but because it kind of codified and popularized a sound that then kind of took over the world for a while. That's George Benson's reason.
You should point out, it was I read this today and I was shocked to hear this. It was the first jazz album to go platinum.
Oh, I did not know that.
I mean, you'd think of all of the jazz albums that, you know, everyone had to have. This was the first album to go platinum. And I don't know what is that, 500,000 copies or something? At some number. It was the first, supposedly the first jazz album to make that threshold. And it did it all at once. It wasn't like over 40 years, everyone owns a copy of Kind of Blue. It's like this came out in, what was the year, 76? And
By 77,
everybody had a copy.
With a gold certification, redefining means sales of 500,000.
Are you looking at platinum?
So,
isn't that amazing? It was the supposedly, I don't know where I read that. I read it when I was reading around for this podcast. I can't remember where I saw that, but supposedly it was the first jazz album to go platinum.
Well, and interestingly, what this claims is that platinum certification was introduced in 1976, which was the year this came out. I had not realized that. I knew it was very successful. And I did have a chance. I mean, I've been using Spotify now that I finally got myself signed up to do, you know, outside listening, which is something I probably should have done years ago. So I listened to a couple records that Benson did with, I believe in, or I don't know if it was Jimmy McGriff or some other organ player. You know, he's kind of got a, this is not an artist who comes out of nowhere. Right. Benson's been around for a long time at this period. He's done work on CTI. He's also done work in soul
jazz. Interestingly, his CTI work was Bob James Free. It's all Creed Taylor produced, so no strings. So he had a run of six or seven albums on CTI before Breezin. And Breezin was, I think, the first album he did with Warners. So
I think
he had a run
right.
of like six or seven when he got the CTI. But yeah, he or someone said, keep that Bob James motherfucker away from my guitar. And that was it. There's a lot of Jack DeJohnette and Ron Carter on those discs. Ron Carter's on almost every single one of them. And Jack DeJohnette's on like four of them. Ron Carter is more present in this music than I ever would have guessed until this podcast. But he's like the go-to bassist on a lot of these CTI releases in this era, which again, I would not have reckoned on that. So anyway, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the albums I've championed in kind of the almost easy listening vein is Paul Desmond Summertime, which was released on A&M, but was a production by Creed Taylor. And, you know, Ron Carter's on that. And yeah, CTI was, a label that we've talked about some of their productions before, some electricity in jazz, certainly some smoother sounds. But the musicians playing on those sessions tended to be top-notch. Some of Herbie Hancock's, I think, greatest mainstream solos are on Summertime. It's just kind of amazing the level of talent they had on some of those productions. Yeah, and you could argue that, like, Freddie Hubbard, and we did a whole show on Hubbard, in some ways he maybe finds his groove the best at CTI. Yep. I mean, I love his Blue Note stuff, but his most distinctive work might be on CTI. I like a lot of their productions. Not all of them, of course. I mean, they're, you know, no one needs the giant box or whatever.
There's a whole run of Rashawn Roland Kirk albums that are Creed Taylor joints that are very good as well after he leaves Mercury. So that's a good period for Roland Kirk as well.
It's interesting stuff, but again, you have to kind of get past the border of produced sounding jazz. If you just hate that, if you hate knowing there's a producer involved and extra musicians, you'll never like this. It's making no bones about the fact that it is not just an acoustic event with a few musicians in a room and a mic or two. It's trying to be different from that. One thing I found out listening to Benson is, man, he's a player. He's got a hell of a lot of technique. He likes to play fast. He's not necessarily, given those things, somebody you'd peg for superstardom. And I guess the secret was, even if he's not the most lyrical guitar player or the player who with the simplest lines, he found a way to overcome that. And that was his voice, yeah. Right? I mean, I assume.
And I got to say, do you like his vocals?
Well, I find them inoffensive, I guess. I don't know that, you know, and he only sings on one song. This Breezin' is a 6-song album.
Right.
And boy, a couple of these productions are, it took me 3 or 4 listens to hear anything but the ultra light, ultra smooth sound of the production. And then I realized he's soloing fairly intensely here. I mean, I want to talk about him as a soloist in a minute. Yeah, This Masquerade, I heard that probably 400 times as a kid. It was a huge, huge hit. I don't know that I found him a distinctive vocalist. Did you have a feeling about the singing other than it? I don't know. I mean, I don't think he's out of tune.
Breezin' is, you know, you've heard Breezin' so often that when you hear it on an album, it's like, oh yeah, that. I've heard that a million times before. But This Masquerade is a little bit of an earworm for me. It kind of got into my head a little bit. He's not a great singer, but he's a light soul singer, if you will. But it's like he knows what he can do, and he gets the max out of what he can do. He's very effective on that song. I do like his vocals there quite a bit. And they got into my head for whatever reason. I can't kind of shake that song. The other ones I can't remember.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I cannot remember. 6-4, Affirmation, So This Is Love, and Lady. They're all perfectly... Well, as you said, they're incredibly slickly produced. And you're right, he is soloing at speed on a lot of these, but I'll be damned if I can remember a thing he does. And every time I hear them, it's like, oh, it's George Benson. They just don't register for me at all. Go ahead and say what you're going to say about him as a soloist. I kind of want to hear what you think.
And that's their job. Well, I think I decided that he's very technically adept. He's very quick. I don't know that he's somebody that, as I've listened to him in other contexts, I mean, one of the songs he covers on one of those CTI joints is Take 5. So I had to listen to Take 5. He plays it pretty quick. I don't know that he's somebody that as a musician, as an instrumentalist, plays phrases that stick with me very hard, even in the hardcore jazz context.
Right.
They're well executed. They're quick. He's got great technique. But one, I think he's too quick too much. In other words, he plays a lot of fast phrases. And one thing you'll find very rapidly, unless your name is Parker and your first name's Charlie, that if you don't vary that, it doesn't, the effect is lost, right? If you play just a string of 32nd notes or 16th notes on and on and on, there's no sense of speed anymore. It's just fast. It's just, you know, a lot of notes.
And would you argue that the production doesn't serve him? Well,
it serves him brilliantly in that the whole point of the production is something that you can listen to without listening to it.
Right.
He is not the equivalent of a David Sanborn or a Hank Crawford on guitar at all. He's way more Baroque and he's way more, I don't think pastel's the right term, but just not, he doesn't have a gift of the stinging phrase or the memorable turn. It's just kind of decoration. And so
he's not Sonny Chirac.
God, no. But I mean, he's just not. He's just, even Grant Green, you know, sometimes his licks annoy me. But I mean, I remember them. It's just he plays them too often. But Grant, as you think of a simple, straightforward communicator with just a gorgeous tone, is miles beyond Benson, even though Benson's technique is miles beyond Grant. And so what I think it's Tommy Lapuna. I hope I'm saying that right. He recently passed away. He produced, among other people, Diana Krall for a while. And he's just a uber producer type guy. And he created something that was just like a souffle. And he realized that no one is here paying money to hear Benson's guitar licks other than as frosting. So make them frosting. Don't feature them. And I think the money shot, I think what makes Masquerade so memorable and successful, along with the fact it's a great song by Leon Russell, it's got some great, you know, just playing it is just fun. I mean, there's some interesting harmonic changes in it, in blues notes and whatever. It's just a damn good song with great bones. The money shot is... Yeah. that's the kind of thing that seems like almost supernatural. It's like, how's he doing that? He's singing, but he's playing. Mm. It's the same time. It's the same notes. He's a magic man. And that's where, you know, that trick is what I think sells that fucking song. I think if it didn't have that, I just, you know, and I think the song sells the fucking song, but I think that's what hooked people. A combination of decent, not brilliant vocal, great, smooth production, but then that weird thing at the end. Anyway, that to me is like his one gift. It's the one thing you remember about Benson is this. And, you know, other people have done it. Sam Stewart did it, for God's sakes. Hugely annoying. He'd hum along with his bowed bass. No one wants to hear that shit. But Benson does it in this light way, but somehow together, his voice and his guitar, to me, draws more attention than either of them apart. Anyway, that's my take.
What I find kind of striking here is, you know, he had that run on CTI where it's like he banished Bob James from the studio, right? And so we get the CTI, we get the Kudu treatment, but light, because Creed Taylor's behind the board, and there's no violins, there's no strings, there's some horns, but it's a smaller ensemble. So it's sort of, you know, it's dialed back. And then he goes to Warner's, and it's like, he's like, fuck that horn shit. Let's have the Bob James arrangements. So it's just strings and synths here, and there's no brass. There's no weight here. Like you said, it's all light as a feather, and it's frosting on top, and it sells a billion copies. It's like he out Bob James.
Oh, by far. I mean, because I, you know, James's Kudo arrangements to me have a certain amount of bite and interest and almost funk to them. Surprisingly so, given how
it's the horns.
Yeah,
it's the horns. He's got the horn arrangements in there that have some real. Some of them have some swing. They have some nice counter lines.
Right.
There's none of that is here. There's no tension here.
Yeah, I mean, think of the low brass on some of the Soulbox stuff. And then, yeah, here, there's just, it is, I think that in a sense, and of course, James himself had this insight that you can just remove the bottom entirely. You can remove any connection with, I don't want to say African American, because I mean, African Americans love this stuff. I don't know, what do you want to call it? Any connection with kind of that soul or blues.
I was going to say, the other thing this reminded me of when I heard it was, I remembered this when I was listening to Breezin. I don't know if you remember watching, do you remember it was ABC's Wild World of Sports. You remember that back in like the 70s when we were kids? And then they would have like golf on, you know, sometimes. And the cutaway music when they would go to a commercial was like George Benson's Breezin. It was like, it wouldn't necessarily be Breezin. It would be one of the tracks from this album. But it would be, you know, it's that sort of smooth, groovy synth, violin, little bit of guitar noodling on top. We'll be back after these announcements. As they, you know, as the Goodyear blimp shows footage of Pebble Beach or whatever golf course they're at. Like, it had become so removed from any urban context that it could just be like groovy Sunday afternoon music to watch White Men in Plaid, you know?
There you go. So you're saying the subtitle of the song could have been Music to Play Golf By.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I remember when I was listening to it, I was like, I'm having flashbacks to sitting in front of the TV on a Sunday afternoon as a kid watching golf, you know, or not paying attention to golf, doing something else, but seeing that, you know, and hearing this music as background noise to. And Jim, what's happening on the 14th tee?
Looks like a man named Patrick is cutting his wrist because he hates golf so much. Wow, cool. Back to you. Yeah, Joyce's granddad used to watch golf, and she just always was just amazed. I mean, that is literally Zen television. It's like, well, we couldn't get the aquarium channel, so we're going to watch a bunch of guys putting. You know, nothing wrong. I guess there's some drama.
And they all have to talk in that hushed whisper. What's he got, Bob? Is that an alto or soprano?
He's tuning
like
in.
A soprano, Jim.
He's going to strum. And I think, you know, just to, in terms of one of the narratives I constantly hear about these guys is, oh, they went to this smooth jazz, but they were good jazz musicians, and it was such a loss, and it's just a pity they didn't make more straight-ahead records, and blah, blah, blah. I think for largely that's just bullshit. I maybe not so much in the case of Sanborn. One, if you want to hear straight-ahead George Benson, there is plenty of it out there.
I agree.
Two, I think when you listen to it, you realize he is finally not that. He's a very good player. He's got a lot of talent. I mean, this is a very talented musician. I don't think he's a very interesting player. He's technically very adept, but
he doesn't have a lot to say.
Right. He is a superstructure kind of guy. He is very good at playing a lot of notes.
Yes.
And I think that's the case back in the 60s. I don't think that changed. And again, you know, put Grover Washington in a hardcore right. jazz situation. He does okay, but there are just so many people that are better at just the raw production of jazz. And his gifts were a very distinctive tone right. and a, you know, ability to reach people on a kind of direct level that many jazz musicians don't have. Both of those music have place. I mean, one of them gets a lot better remunerated than the other. And it doesn't seem fair to people that love jazz that it's the populace, but that's, you know, whatever you want to make of that. That's capitalism, I guess. But I don't think these guys were a loss. I think they were playing what they wanted to play. I certainly don't think, I mean, George has just looked happy as a cat with a cream for the last 30 or 40 years. He's like, this is awesome. Look at my suits. Look at my pencil mustache, baby. You know?
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, there it is. I mean, like it or loathe it. I Breezin to me, it's just so Teflon. It took so long and there is some substance there. But my God, you've really just got to kind of train yourself out of listening to the non-entity of it and listen and keep your ears focused to actually hear, oh, there's guitar. As you say, they kind of bury him. But those flurries of notes are not what the listeners that they were aiming for wanted. They wanted something to play golf by.
Right.
Of these albums, it's probably the one that I enjoyed the least at one level, though I think Masquerade is, again, just that. That riffing and playing at the end, you know, it's just kind of, it's its own thing. It's just very distinctive. But its job wasn't to please me. And really none of these records. I just have gotten to the point where if I'm in the right mood, I'm up for some soul jazz. It's, again, not what I'd want all the time. But sometimes Anthony Braxton is not what your morning is calling for. And there you go. Wouldn't it be great if Anthony Braxton did Soul Box? Anthony Braxton Soul Box? I would pay fucking money. Could they get the master tapes, take out Grover's track, and just stick Anthony in there? That'd be so fucking awesome. Minute 13 of Aubrey. You know, what would happen? Or Audrey or whatever it was. Bad things would happen. It'd be just, oh, man. God. See that? Other people do the killing. Fuck
or
it.
Someone else, like, I've been listening to a little bit of Joe McPhee recently.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's Nation Time. It's Nation Time or Underground Railroad. It's one of those albums where it sounds like he's eating his tenor. Like, it sounds like I've never heard anything like it. He's playing the song, and it sounds like he's taking his tenor apart and eating it. If you hear the album, it might be Underground Railroad. If you hear the song, if you know the song I'm talking about, when you hear it, you're like, he's literally ingesting his horn. Like, that's what it sounds like. How can he keep playing it? There's hardly anything left. He's totally eating his horn, you know? Put him on that album. That would be fun.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Do you know the song I'm talking about?
No, I'll have to go look
There's
it up.
There's one number. It's unbelievable. I think I read about it in the Penguins, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. I got to get this album. And when I heard it, I'm like, holy shit, it sounds like he's eating his horn. They're exactly right. It's incredible.
Sounds like the kind of thing I like to queue up on a regular basis. Oh, man.
It's when you hear it, you'll just be like, oh, my God, that really is accurate. It sounds like the man is chewing his horn segment by segment and somehow still playing it at the same time.
Yeah. But I guess for me to summarize, you know, aside from the strings, and they don't bother me like they bother you, to me, this is a set of music that is part of the tributary that leads to smooth jazz, aside from Breezin, which is smooth jazz. But to me, enjoyable on its own merits in a way that most smooth jazz is not. I mean, I think there's elements to like here. That said, none of these guys are at the level of, in terms of improvisers, not in terms of communicators, some of the best jazz musicians. So you just have to decide, are you in the mood for something funky and soulful rather than, I don't know, technical and intimidating and harmonically challenging? If you are, I think, you know, there's merit here on most of these, and all of these recordings, really. I mean, there's some merit on Breezin, but you just have to kind of get your golf pants on and look for it. It's there in the rough, over the sand dune. Yeah. You'll find it. Any Pop Matters on your mind?
As a kid I know, but
Yeah, so I acquired something that I'm going to have to share with you at some point. I got a copy, which is it's been hard to get. You probably remember the Feelies, their album Only Life from the mid-80s. Remember that?
Yeah, the late 80s. Yeah.
It's Only Life. Well, years later, I picked up another one of their releases Here Before, but I've been for years trying to find a copy of their first release because I heard it's their best, and I finally got it. And it is their best. It's called Crazy Rhythms, and it's from 1980. And you can hear, you know, you can hear what made Only Life, you know, it's like, it clearly is like the dry run for Only Life, which is like two albums later, right? So you can hear some of the songs, you're like, this sounds like they're reaching toward that sound. But what's interesting is it's aptly named Crazy Rhythms. The songs sometimes, you're not sure they've started because they take a long time to fade in. I mean, like a long time, like 30 seconds to a minute before the music actually kind of swells up. And it's just this quartet, and you can hear all of their influences. It's dead fascinating. Like, you can song by song go, right, that's Television. Oh my God, they've been listening to Talking Heads. Like, you can hear, and you know, that's the Velvet Underground. And, oh, listen, they're combining those two songs. It's a fascinating album, and I like it a lot just on one listen. I think Only Life is probably more polished, but Crazy Rhythms is more interesting. So I'll have to let you give this a listen soon to see what you think. But it's hard to find. It for a long time it wasn't in print, it wasn't released, and I've been trying to scare up a copy for years, and I finally got a used one through a website that I legally trade music on. So I have the hard disc, you know, the whole
okay.
It's fantastic. It's really interesting, this album. I'll be interested to hear what you think when you hear it, what you make of this early crack at this band. This will be the third album I have by them, but it's by far the most interesting.
And it's kind of a two-guitar band, right?
Yep, two guitars, bass, drums, but it's you know, when you say that, they're not thrashing. You know, it's like kind of, it's like, it's almost like they're both playing rhythm guitar.
You know, yeah.
Okay. Neither one of them is really soloing. It's very sort of doo 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 doo. They're just playing off of each other for the most part. They don't really, neither one of them really solos.
Cool.
Okay. And they do play in weird time signatures. So the title is apt. I'm not going to call it jazz, but they do play weird time signatures. So you're like, this is not 4/4. What the fuck is this? Like, you have to count it out in your head. Like, what the hell are they doing? So it's kind of interesting. I'll be interested to know what you make of it when you finally get around to listening to it.
Cool. Anything else on your
mind? There's other stuff, but that's the one that I'm really interested in. What have you been listening to?
Well, I did give a listen to Skeleton Tree by Nick Cave.
Mm.
And yeah, I got to say, I guess I didn't realize, because it's been a while since I've heard his music, and I haven't listened to his most recent releases, how far away we are from something like Let Love in terms of just the sound, right? It's just much more ambient, electronics-based. Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of tremolo guitar anymore. And I was struck by the fact that so many of the songs on this album are almost kind of poetry recitations rather than songs, right? There's a lot of words. Now, the last two tunes are the most moving, and of course, as you mentioned, This is some of the albums recorded in the shadow of the death of one of his sons, which is just, I can't even imagine.
Yeah. There's a female vocalist on one of them. Right. I think it's on Distant Sky, and it's like just, it's fucking haunting.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that, I think that's like the penultimate song, and that Skeleton Tree. Yes. Those work the best for me. I guess the ones that are more like songs, like, your mileage may vary depending on how you feel about stream of consciousness kind of poetry readings over music. I mean, I would say that as opposed to like Let Love In, which is one that I know pretty well, those are all songs. Some of them are very intense with really dark and disturbing imagery, but they are presented as songs. Whereas here it's more poetry with accompaniment sometimes.
And I've listened to in the last year a lot of his music now. I've got 7 or 8 CDs at this point by him. I kind of been kind of digging deeper into his catalog, and as he matures, as he's gotten older, he's around our age, he might be a little older than us in fact, as he's matured, he's gotten away from the sort of camp goth interest in death,
right,
as a kind of macabre form of hipster self-reference. And now it really feels like he's thinking about it. Like the singer on this song has a connection to death that, say, the guy on Let Love In or Murder Ballads or Abattoir Blues doesn't. Like, that is a pose. That's a hipster pose. And it's fun. He's really good at it. But I get the feeling he's not posing on this album.
Well, sure. And, you know,
he's invested in
right.
the lyrics here in a much more immediate way. There's no more, there's the ironizing distance is gone.
Yeah. And the other thing I'd say about him is that just as a young person, you're like, oh, this is so cool and everything. And I think that he'd be a very interesting person to talk to. Now,
yeah.
Elvis Presley actually probably would be a very interesting because he was just nuts. But as a musical thinker or architect, Elvis Presley is not as interesting, right? His career wasn't self-directed, whatever. But if I want to listen to one of the two of them sing, I want Elvis Presley. I mean, he just, I guess this is a running theme on what I'll talk about with the pop stuff. As I get older and older, I kind of realize in a more brutal fashion just who was gifted as a singer and who is like getting by. Because so many people in pop can get by. And I mean, he's not a bad singer, but I would pay so much money to hear Elvis Presley sing every song and Let Love In. I mean, it would be so, he wouldn't know what it meant. But it would be so fucking good. You know, can you just, damn. You know, it's not fair. You may not like Elvis very much or respect him or whatever or think he's some kind of joke, but holy fucking shit, that motherfucker could sing.
So you're saying you would endorse Michael Bublé recording the Nick Cave catalog?
I would endorse Nick Cave meeting Michael Bublé in a broom closet. And whatever happens stays in the broom closet. And if two men go in and one man leaves, that's okay with me. Still waiting on the Bublé. Okay. Can't wait. I'm anticipating it. Did
I'm afraid you're going to lose it in Sweden. You're going to like leave it in a bus station if I mail it to you. That's what I'm worried about.
You can just send a rip. It's okay. Yeah, I might lose it. Yeah, actually, that would probably be considered some kind of international act of terrorism. I ended up in prison. It's like, you were trying to leave some Bublé in a public area, sir. We're going to have to take you in. We don't appreciate that kind of thing in our country.
Put you on a watch alert.
Absolutely. God, what have you been getting in the mail?
You'll be on a do not fly list.
Oh, God, it's fun. I'm constantly fighting.
This is an improvised explosive device. How dare you?
There you go.
Terrorist.
It's okay. Sorry. If you don't put it in the CD player, everything's fine. You can, that's the way you disarm it. So anyway, I got Matthew Sweet's latest album. You were mentioning a while back you'd listened to 100% Fun. This is called, it's called Shit. Tomorrow Forever. And it's worth mentioning, I know you hate me talking about covers, it's like a sideways shot of this painted girl in clown makeup. Very cute. And it's important because I've realized listening to this record, just like Girlfriend, remember that amazing shot of the girl with the fur hood? Is it?
Yes.
Women aren't real to Matthew Sweet. They are only idealized. I mean, when he sings about women, it's always a fantasy figure. Now, I don't know. I mean, he may have a really great love life. I don't know. But in his music, it's not like Bob Dylan eviscerating his most recent lover or something. It's just, it's like a cartoon that he's longing for, but not a person. Boy, it sounds a lot like 100% Fun or Girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
30 years later or whatever it is. Technical difficulties. So anyway, I moved over to talking about Procol Harum's Salty Dog. Have you ever listened to one of their albums? I mean, we've all heard A Whiter Shade of Pale.
God, but I have. Let me check real fast. I have one album by them, I think. And it may be the one with Whiter Shade. It'll take me 2 seconds to check. I have nothing by them. Okay, so I'm wrong. Yeah, I know Whiter Shade of Pale, but I don't have any music by them, alas.
Yeah, years and years ago, I got Shine On Brightly, which was their second release. And the first half of that I like pretty well. The second half is like an album sidelong suite, and I haven't explored that much. Salty Dog is their third, and there's a number of blues numbers on it. One of the tunes off this album was covered on that The Great Un-American Songbook album we did, that big band, Eddie Palmerose, you know.
And,
you know, I think I decided their lead singer, because, you know, people will begin their discussions of these records by saying, people have forgotten this band. They were really good. They had several solid releases, late 60s, early 70s, but they've been forgotten unjustly. And, yeah, Salty Dog is a fun record. I find it enjoyable. A couple of the tunes are quite moving. But my theory is Gary Brooker, the singer, someone pointed this out in one of the writing. He sounds a little bit like one of the singers on the band. You know, it's that kind of strained soul voice. Yeah, just a little bit.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think the difference being in the band, it's always they're kind of straining for an Americana, deep feeling, homey sound. And Gary's just the lyrics that he's singing, which are not his, are always kind of lightly psychedelic. And there's just something distancing about everything about Procol Harum. I like them, but they aren't, you don't connect with them on a human level very much. And most of the songs that really strike home are kind of weirdly about people kind of in weird situations, being distanced from their own experiences, kind of out of their minds. Or, you know, I think the Salty Dog is about a bunch of sailors apparently who are dead and, you know, finding some kind of Valhalla on the sea. They've gone to the afterlife. Right? It's not clear, but that's kind of the implication. And that's where he's at his best. Or like Shine On Brightly is a great song with this just stinging kind of one-note guitar riff, and it's about somebody losing his mind. So I think that that's my theory on this band. They are good. This is a pretty solidly put together record from the early 70s, but there's just something about them that I think for most of us doesn't connect in a human level. Anyway, I recommend listening to it, but there's just something about his vocals that seems oddly distancing.
Their most recent album came out in April of this year.
Yeah. There's apparently a classic lineup. It broke up, and they've been intermittently active since then.
Back.
I have not followed their career.
Yes.
But
they're back. I haven't either. I was just looking it up, and it's been 14 years since their last album. And then before that, it was 8 years. And before that, it was 4 years. And before that, it was 14 years. So after the 70s, it's like they come back about the same frequency as Locusts.
Yeah.
Which some people think that's kind of what Gary Brooker's voice sounds like.
Well, you know, it's a little strained, but again, it's just, there's a kind of spacey psychedelic edge to the attitude of it. It's just like he's looking down on his own body. I like it in certain tunes. I mean, Whiter Shade of Pale, it works. Shine On Brightly, it works. The Salty Dog, it works great. But there are just very few moments where you feel like you're in a room with other human beings. And there's one song called Boredom on this album that actually is the most humanly engaging thing on the record. And it's actually kind of fun. It's kind of a Caribbean sounding thing. It's like Jimmy Buffett with brains or something. Anyway, just a passing thought. I went to a recital here in London. I've been to a couple in this cathedral-like church. It's not a cathedral. There's no transom, but it's a huge, beautifully decorated church. And listen to this guy singing various songs by Bertolt Brecht and Joni Mitchell, most of them in other languages than English. And he was accompanied by a guy that could play saxophone, soprano or tenor, or accordion or piano. And then sometimes they'd add a second player on piano if the guy was playing saxophone or accordion. So very well done, though the guy's tone, as brilliant as it was a little bit saccharine on saxophone. But I realized listening to it in that acoustic, this sounds like ECM almost. And I wondered, it suddenly struck me, is this where the ECM sound came from? Did the producer go to these kind of recitals in giant churches as a child and decided that's the way music should sound? I don't know. I just thought. But it's like, you know, if you want ECM, just stick a couple microphones in a giant-ass fucking church, and you've got ECM. Just a passing flippant thought. And that concludes episode 125 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. We're still refining our procedures overseas here, and we're hopeful that pretty soon things will get back to normal. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com or, of course, our Facebook page. We're hopeful that by the time this episode goes live, we'll have established a relationship with the All About Jazz website. If things work out as planned, we'll be posting monthly columns summarizing what's happened on the podcast, and I'm hoping to publish some reviews as well. Tune in next time as we discuss work by Bud Powell, Mary Lou Williams, Tad Dameron with Fats Navarro, and Ferret Oatman. Till next time, take care. It's funny, but, you know, here in Sweden, the minute you speak English, almost everybody will start speaking beautiful English to you. And then they'll apologize. It's so funny. It's like, no, I'm in your country. It's my fault that I don't know Swedish. It's just, I want you to know that you can talk to me all you want. And even though I'm blonde and blue-eyed, I have no idea what the fuck you're saying. That's all. I mean, it's not your fault. Yeah, what's going on?